you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, and all the places.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently making my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant and a producer's rep, and I used to work at Sundance. On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 298 from December 2020 with director Derek Pressley and producer Jason Starnes, who talk about making their second feature, Redstone, and how it's led directly into their next feature. Alric thought this was a good match for Ty and Rhodes because Derek and Jason are another director-producer combination team. And they talk about how they work together, similarly to how Rhodes and Ty did. After that, we play another round of, do we play it? Yes, we do. We play another round of You're the Expert. But first, before we do that, don't forget to check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. It's how we keep the show going. Also, if you're looking for other amazing things to do for us, check out Apple Podcasts /iTunes and leave us a rating or a review. Oh, wait, we have a new rating or review. That's so exciting. I'm going to read it. Oh, it's from Nathan Blackwell. Okay, so Nathan Blackwell was on the show, so we must admit that. But also, separately, he wrote us a review and it says, subject line, an indispensable resource for filmmakers. Nathan writes, the path to becoming a filmmaker sometimes feels like you're alone in the jungle, struggling to move in a direction while you're holding what might be an out-of-date map. This podcast is a fantastic resource to tap into the experience of other filmmakers, to listen to their successes and failures, all guided by the passion of Alric and Liz as they continue their own journey as filmmakers. Oh, Nathan Blackwell!
Thanks,
that
Nathan.
That was great. Yeah, thanks,
amazing.
Man. But without any more further bibble babble or lovely compliments from Nathan Blackwell, here's our throwback interview with Derek Pressley and Jason Starnes.
So today we've got Derek Pressley and Jason Starnes on the show. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So we're going to start with our rapid-fire questions about your new film, Redstone, which is currently in post-production, I believe. How many days do you guys shoot the film?
June 8th to July 1st. Those were the dates. Weekends off. So we had an 18-day, I guess 19, we had a drone day that didn't require any actors, but 19 total days of shooting.
What was the budget, or what are you allowed to say the budget was?
It was an MPA, so it was below 750, but I can tell you it was above 500.
And then how long did you guys work on the film from the inception to it eventually coming out?
January, I guess. We started, I guess the end of January. So February to, we're actually in sound right now. And so what's January now? It's 9 months, I guess. Yeah. We're almost done. We're ready to take it to market at the end, 2 weeks now.
Wait, let's rewind. Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
You thought of the movie right before the pandemic started. The pandemic started. You were like, fuck it, let's make this movie. And you're like almost done with the movie, but we're still in a global pandemic. I just want to like say it out loud. Okay.
Yeah. Well, pretty much. I think it's a little bit different than that, though. Like, the conception started like end of January, right? So we were actually thinking we were moving forward. We were going to shoot in April. Like, so we had started pre-pro February, basically that month. And we were going to shoot in Fort Worth. So we started scouting and getting a PO. So we got an offer. And our line producers, you know, this was like the beginning of COVID, right? That people were thinking, this isn't real yet or whatever. Because that was him. That was Austin Williams. It was like, this is just going to blow over. And then like literally the next week it was like, you know, he's eating his shoe or whatever that term is. So then we kind of shut down and had to regroup. And then we started, I guess it was about May, back up, Derek. I mean, we never really stopped.
During quarantine was when we got all of the legalities, all the SAG stuff started. We started going to where we started having Zoom meetings pretty much every single day between the three of us and Austin Williams, our line producer, Jason, Alex Blackman as well, who's the EP and one of the EPs. And yeah, I mean, what it was that pretty much just like Jason said, I mean, like we were ready to go. We wanted to film this in April. And when we got shut down, it was probably biggest blessing, or I don't know how to say that. It sounds really bad because this is an awful thing that's happened. But I mean, like, we benefited no doubt from COVID, because when we shut down, we were able to take our a little bit more time finding the right cast, and not that we were rushing, but you know, when things like that happen, people are open all of a sudden. Projects are, I mean, like, see, like, you know, McDonough and the Cudlets, you know, they're big players. They play in big films and stuff. And those films, as you guys know, I've listened to those podcasts. Y'all are talking about it. I wanted to buy you guys a Coke and cheer you up on one of them. Y'all were really depressed sounding. y'all were like, man, this sucks. And I was like, I agree with you. I was listening to it and I was going back. And it just changed the entire aspect of the world. But yeah, for us, it was as soon as it opened up, you know, we had a better cast for it. And we were able to, we went to another location that was way better. And, you know, it was, like I said, I hate to say it, it sounds horrible, but it was a blessing. So,
yeah.
Sorry, I took us on a detour, but the next question is how big your crew was.
I think we were total 26, 27 on our crew sides. And then our cast was about the same, 28, I think, our cast total.
Yeah, it wasn't too many.
And then out of all the projects you guys have worked on, how difficult was this one? Man.
Extremely difficult. Extremely difficult.
Yeah, just simply because juggling the what we were just talking about, COVID, I think it made it, yeah, by far the most difficult. Let me for sure. But you know, the previous film that we did, we shot a film in November and it was that's out. We're selling that one right now. Last November. And so that one was a 12-day shoot, you know, and it was 12 days in the winter in the forest. And I was sick. I had like 100-degree temperature about 4 of the days of our 12-day shooting. It was just, you know, I couldn't talk. And Jason was doing like 18 positions and, you know, our crew was probably 10 to 15 people.
Yeah.
And I was so wanting to go back to that. Midway through Redstone, I was like, God, I just wish we could do that again, because that was this wasn't as nerve-wracking.
I should probably clarify that, Liz. Like, difficulty wise I mean, extremely difficult. I would say making the movie wasn't like just like hard to get things together and do, you know, filmmaking. It was the stress was so much higher because
you were worried about any second someone could get sick and shoot and shut you down.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or somebody didn't agree with something or maybe felt unsafe or something. I mean, we were really concerned about that, but that was the biggest thing. We were the first film to green light when Hollywood reopened, and literally going into it, let's see, we started shooting June 8th. It was Friday the 5th. Where we got greenlit. We got the email from SAG at 4 p.m. on that Friday. We had cameras up on Monday. And wow. I think that Monday was when Texas, I think it was that Monday. It might have been that.
It was.
Was it Monday when Texas said, hey, you're allowed to shoot again. Like, we were just going. Like, we were like, okay, we're doing this. Like, everything's in place already. And we're still a small budget film. We had no room to like, okay, we got to push this. 2 weeks or whatever. So it was a huge leap of faith.
Plus, the last thing I was going to say about that was, if you don't mind, was the, that we had a debate. I think Jason may have been the only one. I may have jumped onto his side at one point, but we were all saying, why don't we just wait until July, guys? We know it's hot. It's just nasty. But of course, I'm a big prep guy. And I was like, oh, that'd give me way more time and it'd just be so much better. And the cases will hopefully go down, right? You know? Yeah. Right. And the place we were shooting at spot, I mean, and we wouldn't be able to do this. I guess we could have, but it would have been even worse if we hadn't shot in June. Jason was saying, no, we got to shoot now. We got to shoot now. And I was saying, dude, it's right off the opening. Like, man, I'm scared.
Yeah. I think if we hadn't moved the location, I don't know that we would have gotten the green light anyway. So we originally were going to shoot in Fort Worth, and I don't know what the numbers were. They were in the thousands as far as cases go. And we ended up shooting, what was it, Derek?
About 20-something thousand people had at that point.
Ooh, it was a lot. So we ended up moving the entire production, which to Corsicana, Texas. And that's in a county called Navarro County. And the whole county had 36, I believe, cases in the county. So we did some research. And then in the city itself, there was only 8 active cases. And so that was a big deal for us to move, but then we had to, you know, go and quickly start rescouting and finding the right locations in the city, but it just worked out perfect.
Was there some sort of film commission or anything you had to get clearance from in that county, or was it just the city themselves that letting you do it? Like, how did that work?
Yeah, it's the city itself. We were able to work. The city's great for filming in, so they're a little hidden gem in Texas as far as shooting. They really welcome filmmaking in that city, and so they gave us free rein to a lot of stuff and helped us get the locations, which was just, again, if we didn't go there, this movie didn't happen. So
yeah, for example, we have a scene, just for a little example, like, you know, in the actual downtown strip, main street, right, where a girl gets abducted by two thugs and she's screaming bloody murder. And then about, you know, later on that day, we did a company move just down the road, which is great about Corsicana where we film, because a company move is like 10 minutes away every time.
Yeah.
And we go down there by this major railroad tracks where there's all of these, you know, and we're safe. We're way off away from it, but we're in there, all these businesses, and we're shooting, you know, live rounds. Well, not live, whatever you call them.
Blanks,
you know.
Yeah.
And all I had to do was call up Lauren Bledsoe, who is our
associate producer.
Associate producer who works with the city, and one of our producers, Robert Johnson's he's the chief of police there. So we call him up and say, hey, we're shooting guns, guys. So, okay, cool. Thanks for letting us know in case somebody calls the police. I mean, you know, you can't do that. You got permits and you got to make all this stuff. Right. So it was pretty crazy. It's a good little place to shoot.
I was supposed to shoot a feature in June. So this is just hilarious to me, because we couldn't even consider going forward, but we couldn't cast. We got, like, reps weren't getting back to us. And it wasn't usually I cast my film. So we actually had a legitimate casting director this time. So when you said that Cudlitz and McDonough were open, did you get this sense that actors wanted to act and wanted to jump on board projects? Like, that's new intel as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, they were, you know, I'll say this, they almost had, to me, I don't know what Jason got out of this, but when I was talking to them, I don't want to say, I don't want to use the word ignorant, but whatever the equivalent is, they were almost like oblivious, like their agents kept them hidden from it, because they were like, they would call us up 2 weeks before we shot. Cudlitz especially would be like, how are we going to do this, by the way? I mean, are we good? Yeah. I mean, what? You're not freaking out about this? No. I mean, I got to do quarantine? Oh my God. So we got to get on the, you know, Jason, and then we're on the phone with the agents and stuff. And McDonough was just he's a cheerleader from the beginning. You know, he became executive producer on it.
You know what? Everybody had been in quarantine for so long. They were ready to get out. I think, Derek, you should tell the story about Neil calling you. Neil likes to, McDonough, whatever. Neil likes to, he likes to FaceTime with you, and he calls. He's very personable like that. Just such an amazing guy. But the story, Derek, that I think you should tell is when he's washing dishes, he's FaceTiming with you, and he's like, "I got to get out of here."
Oh yeah, yeah. He's straight up. He's washing dishes, and I'm and the funny thing was, I was washing dishes. You know, we're both in quarantine. I've got a 7-year-old. He's with me. He's got 5 kids or something.
Neil's and he's 5. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's sitting there washing dishes, and I can hear him, and I'm like, "I'm washing dishes." He goes, "I'm washing dishes." I was like, "Oh, cool." And I was like, and he said something. He goes, "Derek, I got to get out of here. I've just got to get out of here." He's like, "This is happening, right? Like, I'm flying out in 2 weeks, right?" And it wasn't anything about it, because he's, you know, one thing about Neil that you'll know is he's the most devout family man in the universe. There's nobody else like him. It's insane. And but it was more of just he was going stir crazy being in one location.
Yeah. So. And I think that was another huge blessing for us, is crews, like, everybody needed to go to work. Everybody wanted to go to work. Actors wanted to go act. So I think at the point that they were like, "I'm just going to risk it," we're not really that concerned. But then once we put a COVID guideline book together ourselves, because here's the other thing that made us really lucky. This was before SAG put out their own guidelines when we were shooting. So we were in the middle. If we'd have had to follow those guidelines, which we will on the next shoot, it would have cost a lot more money, and it's going to cost a lot more. But our next movie is, we have more money to deal with it, because those guidelines are really strict and really tough. Financially, they're tough. So
you just snuck in at an opportune time where they didn't have guidelines, but were able to say yes to you.
Yeah. Well, we wrote our own guidelines and we sent them. I sent them a book that was like, "This is how we're going to do it." And we were, you know, our guidelines were based on what other big studios were starting to put together as well out in Hollywood. So there were things, I think, like smaller stuff that might have been preparing to shoot. I think there might probably was some commercial stuff that was shooting. There were no feature films, I know that, but we wrote guidelines, and we kind of, in our guidelines, we put the data in there and the numbers and how we were going to do it. And I think that helped them to feel okay and secure that, hey, these guys are going to take
care of it. I think the biggest, that along with the biggest thing you just can't discount was when we show them the cases, we had the city show them what they had. And when you look at that and go, 8 cases, okay, we're good. You know what I mean? And we're out in the sticks. We're hardly in the little town. We're mostly out on the, you know, out on these little roads and stuff. A farm is a big aspect of the movies, or a ranch. So I think, and it was early, like you're saying, it was early on. It was before they had a chance to really, you know, sit down and go, we're going to test 3 days a week. And again, on one of y'all's previous podcasts, one of you, I think Ulrich, you were the one, one of you two had a friend that was shooting, and you said it was like testing. And there was a very small crew. It was an on-SAG. It was a couple of podcasts ago, and you were talking about how they, testing like crazy. It was just so expensive for a small.
Yeah, that was Ulrich, the 3 times a week thing, Ulrich.
Yeah, right, crazy. Right, yeah. I do know another filmmaker who they went and made a movie with a 20-person crew, and they're doing it non-SAG, and so they just didn't test at all. They're just it without testing because they didn't have to go to anybody. Right. They're just doing it all kind of guerrilla style. But so did you guys test at all, or was it just no? Did you test the actors at least, or how did you guys approach testing?
Some people were tested. Some of the actors were tested. Not everybody. I can say not everybody was tested because it was, again, there was not a guideline from SAG to say, hey, you have to test everybody. But some people were. Some people that we actually had one day. This is crazy. So in the script, there's and this is where COVID hit the hardest, was in an elderly home, right? Like a facility. And we shot inside of an elderly home. There was a wing, this basement wing that was not being used, but we had a lot of extras that came in that day that were, you know, 60 plus, 70 plus years old to be as backgrounds.
Wow.
And so like, you can imagine everybody had to play it safe. And so.
Right.
It was also, by the way, it was also Neil's first day.
Yes.
Neil McDonough. And when he walks on the set, this is just really funny. This is the biggest budget I've shot with. And Neil walks on set, and we got 20, maybe, I don't know where we were at, but he sees most of the crew, and he looks around and he goes, I love it. I just love it. This is how it should be. Just like a little family. And I'm looking at him going,
this is a big crew.
And he's like, this is great. You know? And he walks in. He had a blast. Cause he gets to know, there's a couple other people too that work on major productions that were in that movie. And they were like, it's crazy. Like I know everybody. I'm like, well, yeah, you don't have 500 people or whatever they had.
Right.
So, you know, you got 4 people at any given time. So
talk about what you guys did do. So you didn't do testing, but like, were you doing like screening every day for the crew? Like, were you doing temperature checks? Were you doing like bubbles or pods for different departments? Like, let's hear about what you guys did do for your set.
All right. So first and foremost, we did have an advisor. We had a COVID advisor that we had hired, Paul Henley, who is also the city's COVID advisor for the city of Corsicana. So we had hired the right guy. For this, who also got on the phone with us and with SAG to talk about how we were going to handle and deal with it, and how we were going to keep everyone safe. So we did do a pod system, not as well, it's a much smaller team. So, but there was just certain people who were responsible for certain gear that, and this was actually hard for me because I like to get my hands. I just like to help. Like, I'm not a producer that just stands around and just whatever, watches people work. So if like G&E needs to move something, I would go and move something. And I realized, like, going to pick up something, like, I shouldn't be doing this. Like, part of our guidelines was, this is you guys' stuff. We're not gonna.
Right.
And so people would have to take care of their own things. The groups, right, our pods, they would wipe down their own stuff. They would take care of their own stuff. And we had like PAs that were responsible for certain things, wiping things down. There were several times I was actually, pleased. I would see one of our guys, Rex, was wiping down the handles of our star wagons, our trailers, like just going around and wiping them. I'm like, oh, okay. And you know, it wasn't something that I said, hey, you need to make sure you do this every day, go do this, but they were doing it. So everybody was very responsible about it. We did temperature check every day. We did do questionnaire every day to like everybody. So, and we did, we had a little system where certain people were closer to our cast and certain people just stayed away. Like they didn't need to be around them, and they don't need to be around them.
So. We also had our makeup. She was a one person team, and she was only allowed to be in there myself if I needed to talk to them, obviously masks and everything. But she was only just her, and there was nobody else was allowed to touch any of her, you know, things like that. And I think all the guidelines now are a little more defined than they were, obviously, but it's weird because we talked like this was years ago. It was like,
yeah, I know. It was just
because SAG is, you know, they've come out with things, and we're filming our next film in Washington State, and they have their commission is, they have guidelines. We didn't have that. They have this amazing film commission, and they're just like, here, download this. This is what you got.
We did. We had our own guidelines that fit our
needs. We had ours, but we didn't have somebody say, this is what you have to do. So Jason was literally the guy during quarantine there was a film in Iceland, I believe, and Tyler Perry released something as well for Georgia. And I think you were taken from that and kind of making it our own thing.
It sounds like you guys are you're kind of like shooting up in terms of like popularity and busyness at the same time that the world is falling apart. Like, I don't know anyone else who just shot something, who's planning to shoot something else. Like, this is kind of, this very prolific of you. And then you also mentioned, Derek, the sense of like your budgets are getting bigger personally. I don't know for you, Jason, if it's the same situation, but I don't know what the question is. I guess it's like, can you talk a little bit about your like careers growing in this time and what you attribute that to?
Well, I can say that before we did a film in last November that I talked about, and that was, we found an investor the prior year before that, and we had to wait like 10 months to shoot the movie. So we had a ton of prep the summer of like 2019, I guess.
Quick.
We got our little crew together, and I had been on a hiatus from making, so I was more of a genre kind of guy. I was, all my short films and my previous two features were posters behind me. Like, I was obsessed with that kind of stuff. I got City of Lost Children poster right over here. So I had all these things, and I was just kind of tired of making those movies because I don't want to say that they lacked human emotion, but they lacked human emotion. And so we got together and we made this other film. This was more grounded, and we got to really work hard on it. We had a great guy come in, Alex Blackman, who's our partner now. And I think that's where it really started, was like finding this group. And when we made Whitetail, I'm showing the rough to Alex in January, or actually December. So we shot it in November. We had a picture lock in December.
That's right.
And I really think that it's attributed to the fact that like Jason's not really a producer. I mean, he is now, but when I met him, it was a color. He was a colorist on my previous feature before.
Not really a colorist either.
No, he's not. But I met him and I asked him to color the film, and he said, "Well, I really want to get into. I want to do producing more. I want to kind of get out of that stuff." And I was like, "Oh, well, here, you know." And then the next thing I know, you know, he's bringing like 90 different things to the set that there's no way we could have got a codec system. They're doing case studies on Whitetail, this little movie, you know. And sorry, it's a long-winded answer. The point is that we started with that little film. It was made for about 100,000, and then when Alex saw the cut of it, he goes, "Man," he goes, "that's awesome." He goes, "I don't even know if we can make a better film." He really likes it a lot. It's like, which is fantastic. Which you want to hear your investor say.
Yeah, you want to hear your main EP saying, "Yeah, it was a great film.
It was a great film." So then
they
said,
gave you some more money.
Yeah. So what can we do now? And this is before COVID. You know, this was January. So it was really just a little story. And I was like, "Well, I have an idea." I was like, "I'll write it. You know, I'll pitch it to you." And I wrote it and I pitched to him, and he loved it. And the next thing you know, that's Redstone. And Redstone's was that much money, you know, five to 600,000, somewhere around there. And then, and really the next thing was Neil. It's Neil McDonough. Because on the set of Redstone, he just said to me jokingly, and I made an ass of myself because I thought he was joking and he wasn't. But he was like, "Yeah, and then the sequel, you know, he can do this." I was like, "Yeah, right. Sequel. This isn't a sequel type movie, Neil." And I keep going. And then I'm like, "Oh," and he says it again. I'm like, "Oh, you're serious. You're okay. All right." So I was like, "I don't know if I could figure out a way to make a sequel with this and not to give away the ending or anything." But I was, you know, I was like, "I don't know. This is really weird." But when somebody like that then starts telling you more and more he wants to do it, and he can make the next one this and that the bigger. You know, you guys are filmmakers. You know, you're like, oh yeah, I can figure out a way to make a sequel. I can do it. But I did have the rule with him on this next one. I said it can't be a continuation. It has to be like a spiritual sequel.
We're still battling with Derek. He still doesn't believe it's a sequel, and it's really not a sequel. I mean, this movie is really like years later. And if you never saw the first one, you wouldn't think anything of it. But if you did see the first one, there may be some nuggets in there that you'd be like, oh yeah, I could see that. So then
you pitch this idea that you kind of come up with Neil to your investor, and then he just says, yeah, I'm all in, let's do it. Or how does it work?
We were all in before we had Neil. So I'll back up because I kind of tied this story.
He's referring. I think Ulrich's referring to this new one.
To the new one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that was Neil was pressuring me to do that. So we're literally in sound on Whitetail, which is the one we shot before, the one I told you about, the 100,000 one. And then we're editing Redstone, and I'm at the sound studio with Jason, and he calls me up with his agent. Neil does. Neil McDonough, and his agent calls and says, "What are you doing? Get to work." And I'm like, "Haha, it's funny." He's like, "No, seriously, like write this script, the sequel. We gotta because we want to shoot this in the fall of this year." And I was like, I never claimed to be smart, so I was going fall of the year. That's only like 4 months. Oh shit, you know. I called Jason. So anyways. That's how that worked.
Neil, we were in the same place.
We were in the same place. Well, you were in the room. You were in the next room. I was outside. And then so he ends up. So then after that, he ended up staying with it. And I think at that point, throughout the writing of it, I was fighting a little bit. I mean, not to like fighting, not to do it, but just like I was thinking, like, this is just so quick and sudden. How is that possible? We're going to do another film with Neil. With the COVID stuff, the cases are kind of going crazy, and there's now, you know, and it was Neil and obviously Jason and myself, but Neil was this one, he's taken way more of a producing, you know, role, and he's finding the people and the investors. So
Neil's taking on the investment side of this one.
We have
that's amazing.
Yeah. This is a miracle.
What a crazy story.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but
it's wild to think that it's not even been a year yet since we made our first film together, and now we're going into a third film before November of 2020. So
you don't know the revenue for any of these movies. So your investor doesn't seem to care. He seems to care about the quality of the storytelling more than necessarily the return, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, mostly, but I think we know we have a good picture. We already did do distribution on our Whitetail picture, and that had really no big names. And then now you go from that to Redstone, where you have a great cast in Redstone, and then now with the Boone, where it's an even bigger cast who we're throwing around right now. So I think they're just the risk mitigation is a lot lower because of the talent.
So with Whitetail, did you guys make your budget back through your distribution already, or is that still in question?
Yeah, it's still in question because we just started those deals. So international was signed probably a month ago, maybe. It hasn't been.
Okay.
So that's, and then domestic, we're actually waiting on a letter right now for that. So we don't know what we're going to get back on it. Our budget was so low, and it's a really good feature. I can't imagine not at least getting our production back. So.
Never know, guys. You never know.
I know, exactly. You never know. But it didn't matter.
I shot my first feature around the same time you guys shot Whitetail, and mine's not done yet. I'm still working on it, but it's basically we're going into sound and visual effects very soon. I'm like just about ready to lock it. But I mean, I feel the same way. It's like, oh, we made it for so little, like, you know, we should be able to get our money back, no problem. But again, like my producer keeps on telling me, it's like, don't count on it, kid.
Right.
Like, don't count on it.
My job. My job is distribution consulting now. Well, and yeah, nice. I just quit my job. I'm happy to help you guys. Yeah, you can be my client.
We should talk.
Well, but yeah, I mean, I've witnessed the distribution, the releases of a lot of films. And I also did the same pitch when talking to an investor, such low overhead, name, cast, genre, whatever it is. But unless you get those like large license fees from like a Netflix, a Hulu, a premium cable, or an airline deal, which clearly are fallen by the wayside now. Yeah. You can't rely on anything, but you have to say those kind of things to investors. You have to say, we're making a good film with low overhead. So we have a shorter runway to travel, right? But we can talk if you want.
Yeah. No, I also think like with the investors seeing that we were able to produce something, seeing what we were able to do with what little we had, and then going and quadrupling that and then doing it again and just making that much better of a picture. And then now we're hopefully going to do it again. So,
oh my God, I have like 40 questions. But please, Ulrich, go.
I have a COVID specific question. Just kind of going back to Redstone. And this to be clear, have you shot Boone yet, or are you just preparing to shoot Boone soon?
Just pre-pro for Boone right now.
Pre-Boone. Okay. Yeah. So on Redstone, did you guys what'd you do for food? Like, did you have craft services? Did you do breakfast every day? And then how did you guys do that? Did you have a catering company? Like, what was your process for that?
So that was pretty easy. Because we had gone to the individualized packaging for food, right? And that's how you kind of have to do it. So we specifically hired a person to deal with that. And I think there was two people in the set for that, but we did a menu system. So we would have a menu day before, and they would get to order from the place. So people had choice, like as if you were going through a buffet, but they got to choose what they wanted, and they would put in an order, and then the restaurant would prepare that individually wrapped for that person. They'd get their name on it, just like they do in a post house. I don't know if you work in like commercial post, you go into a post house, everybody's food comes, you know, they send a menu around to every room and you tell them what you want, and then they order it and get it. So that's how we dealt with the food situation. So.
And then it was just one restaurant you guys worked with the whole time?
No. We went around. So the city.
That was our agreement, right, with Corsicana, was that we don't go outside of there. We have to use the businesses. And they were opening up, and we were, you know, they were having to pack.
Yeah, we were cycling through. And actually, we got some really good deals on food as well, because we were a big part of restaurants, like, making their money that day.
Right. But
there was probably like four or five restaurants that we would just cycle back, you know, cycle through for food.
Right.
It actually, to be honest, it kind of took me back to the old days. I hadn't done that in a while, where minus that it was not, we didn't have pizza because we'd all be asleep. But you know, when you're making your short film,
that's our rule. No pizza.
You know, you're all like, hey guys, what do you want from Subway? I'm going to send a guy to go to Subway. What do you want? And it was way more organized, but it was weird because I hadn't been on a set where I'm opening up a box from a restaurant in a very long time. You know, it's always, you know, buffet style. So it was nice.
Right.
I liked it. I preferred that way over the other way.
That's the benefit of being in a small town. It's like having easier access to the restaurants being more open to that. You know, I did this similar thing in Tahoe for a feature recently, but it was before the pandemic. So like, we didn't have to worry about, you know, individual stuff. We just did, you know, buffet style. But yeah, that's awesome. So it sounds like it wasn't that big of a deal.
No.
Did you guys do coolers or no coolers?
We did do coolers. But we also had our guy Rex.
I know.
But we had one guy handing out drinks or handling. Or
cheers.
And that wasn't all the time. But no. We also had hand sanitizer on top of every cooler. So before you could go open the cooler, you had to.
We had these cool little bags made up.
Jason
went and got these nice bags that had all the sanitizers and wipes and everything you could have and masks and stuff. And then but you know, yeah, I mean, it is difficult. I will say that for anybody that's about to venture into a feature or short or anything right now, you know, it is difficult. We're not gonna lie and be like, you know, it wasn't hard. I mean, there's some things you just habit, you know, just like Jason was saying.
I was just gonna say that the habit of like, I forgot
myself
I want to shake hands or I want to hug somebody.
Yeah. And then the other thing too is, I wanted to bring this up because this is what your podcast is about, is, you know, the making of things, and hence the title, it's hard. That, you know, we had a couple of moments where we were like, people, you cannot take pictures on set and post them online because people are going to get, not that we were doing anything wrong, but like if you happen to see an actor. And then there's a lot of people that were upset. They weren't making a film. I don't want to say jealous, but they were just like, they're going to hate on it to hate on it, you know? And then it was like, guys, we're not doing anything wrong. Yeah. We're making a film, and they're going to, you know, the actors are not going to have a, you know, a mask on during the scene. So, and there's going to be, you know, and then I'm sorry, I'm a human being. It didn't happen directly to me anyways. I'm just saying that I wasn't personally scrutinized, but I've just, I know people like, oh, can I post this? And we were like, no, like keep it till after the.
I can speak to that if you want. I had an issue with that. Like, I'm on these productions. I've been shooting since July. And we are doing these photo shoots, and I posted some stuff online, and then somehow I got tagged by somebody else online, and he put a tag, and he was saying like, how do these people do these scenes without masks on, blah, 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 all this stuff. And then I'm not sure if he was directly attacking me, but I got into this Facebook thing with this guy, and I was like, well, this is what we did. This is how we did it. You know, it was completely, we followed the guidelines. We were all safe, but I mean, there are people out there who aren't following the rules carefully. And, you know, if they post stuff online, there are people out there who are going to, you know, call you out on it. And, you know, but I mean, yeah, it's definitely an interesting time.
Yeah. I mean, you just do your best. You try, you know, we have the guidelines. Well, actually, I stumbled upon a COVID awareness test online that I sent to every crew member. I have my diploma. Derek has his. So everybody, every crew person took this online COVID test because it was all about COVID awareness, right? And again, because of habit, you kind of forget some things, but you do your best. And like we did it. No one got sick in our movie. No one.
Yeah. Not we had to test.
No one getting it after the movie.
No one's got it. There's something to be said is that some of the crew went directly on another feature filming in Corsicana. And I've kept in touch with a couple of those people, and they're filming now, I think, actually. And it's a Western, and none of them have gotten it yet, so that I know of. Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
What were the contingency plans if there were someone to get sick?
Jason's got a pretty big credit card with a limit on it, so we were just going to max that out and go, no, I'm just kidding. No, Jason, I'll let you answer that one, man.
Man, no, the contingency was to not get sick. we didn't physically have a plan. I think part of producing, and I think just part of making movies, as you guys know, especially indie films, is you just kind of adapt and you go on. We had super responsible people. I'll tell a story about Chelsea Reginald, who's one of our PAs. Yeah, she was PA. She couldn't come back the last week. She called me and said, Jason, I'm sorry, I can't come back. She didn't have COVID. She didn't get sick. She said, my husband's friend's mother got COVID.
And so I love Chelsea right now.
She's amazing. Yeah.
So that, like, but that's the level of type of person you want to have working on your team, right? Because she was responsible enough to forego her pay or anything like that that she would have made for that week. And it was the last week. I think it was the last 3 days of shooting we had. But still, she called and said, so we brought in another PA to fill the role. And that was kind of the contingency. Like, if Derek would have got sick, we would have just brought in a new director.
Easy. He's so replaceable.
You're replaceable, Derek. You hear that?
I sat on this hotel room. So.
Yeah. I mean, my thing is, I told this to our cinematographer, Garrett Schwent, and I told this to Jason as well and myself. I said, on this next film, you know, we're shooting up in Washington. I was like, this is a big step, you know, for all of us. And we got, you know, the only people that we can't replace are the actors.
Yeah.
That's it. If I get it, I'll step down and be like, I'll stay on as a producer, bring in another person. I don't care.
No, he could direct remotely, right? So,
yeah, figure it out. It would be weird, but yeah.
Yeah. But we do it. And I think that's how you do it.
So. Put your actors in some bubble wrap and then put them in a closet when they're not shooting. Let them have some. And that's
They're the most important piece of the pie right now, right? Because they're the ones you can't replace. Everyone else can be replaced or can work through remote system or something like that to still make a picture happen.
Right. Well, so. They're also the ones who are most at risk too. Because they're the only ones who have to take their masks off.
Exactly.
We had a breakdown by SAG. Had to break down every single scene. We're going to have to do it on this one too. We'll probably start working on that very soon. We had to break down every single scene, and we had to diagram and discuss the actors distancing from each other. If it was in a car, how are we going to do that safely? If it was in a scene where I had to actually say, okay, the over the shoulder shots on these. And we're big storyboard, you know, people. So we storyboard our stuff. So I could just take the storyboards and I didn't give it to them, but I could look at it and go, oh, this isn't over the shoulder, and we'll shoot it 6 feet apart and you depth of field or whatever the term is, you know, like that. And we had to tell SAG that every single scene. Well, this person actually, I had to change things, and we already did it in this.
I was going to say that. So, like, script was actually rewritten on several parts of the film because of this. So if you think about doing like a stunt breakdown for SAG, where, you know, they, you send your stunts over and then they send it their stunt guys to break it down. It was the same thing. So I'd tell all the filmmakers that are listening, watching the podcast, you guys, is prepare to do that ahead of time. If you're going to try to go for a SAG film, take your scenes and the ones that, you know, are not like social distance where you have maybe 2, 3 or more actors, and figure out different ways to shoot it. So you can do like a forced perspective or something, or maybe you're going to do VFX where you're going to split and shoot one actor and then another actor, because it's a locked camera. It's a little bit easier to do and do that, because we had to do that. I mean,
also just the smallest details as well, that you can, you know, a kissing scene, try to figure out a way. I mean, we're lucky because I'm not very good at writing romantic stuff. So everything there's not a lot of touchy feely stuff in the things we've done lately. It's just a lot of people shooting people from far away. But, but no, I mean, seriously, it's one of those things where I had a scene in this new film, and it was takes place in a city market. I wasn't even thinking. I'm writing this just a few months ago with Neil. Oh, I forgot to say that Neil's the co-writer on this script. He wrote it with me.
Wow.
So we're sitting there and we came up with this idea and we didn't even think about it till like just a couple of days ago. And I was like, oh, we can't shoot that. And we're like, what? Oh man, COVID. I mean, you know, you just don't think about it. It was a raffle at a city fair.
Oh, a big crowd, 100 people.
Bunch of
people. Man, I was so happy though, because I was like, oh, that's good. Because now logistically, I don't need to worry about that. That's great.
So now it's completely gone. Little things like that are just crucial to the SAG.
In Redstone, there was a scene where a person was supposed to get suffocated with the hand just going over the person's mouth, and he pushed his hand over the mouth and suffocates this guy to kill him, and we just Derek Rebrett saying, well, we'll just shoot him. So it was like,
it was
better.
It ended up being really cool. Yeah, it ended up being way better than what I'd written, but it was one of those things where you just don't think about that stuff.
So I guess we should give props to SAG actually for making us do that, because it actually, if you think about, you know, from the script perspective, you may have to rewrite some stuff based on what guidelines are or trying to be safe. So, and it helped out.
So I know we're winding things down, but I have one more question I want to ask, just about this next movie, Boone. So you talked about like, you're going to have to, you know, have a lot more restrictions COVID related on this one, because you've got different guidelines you're following. Can you just speak really briefly to some of those? Like, are you guys going to have to do testing 3 times a week? Like, what are you guys preparing for on this next one?
So we are preparing. So the way it works now, right, if you look at the current SAG stuff, and Washington Filmworks, who's been amazing. Like, I think Washington, I'm surprised more people don't shoot up there. But they're pretty tight with what the SAG guidelines are. And so, just like the pods, they call them zones, right? You like your zone A people will test. Those are the ones at highest risk, the ones working with the actors, the ones that are closest. Those are the guys that will test 3 times a week. And then you've got your zone Bs, which will be the 1 time a week. And everybody will test prior to filming, starting filming. If somebody's flying in, they need to test before they get on a flight and test after they arrive. But like I said, we're prepared this time budget-wise, which would have killed us on the last one. So we're going into this one with that first, and hiring our COVID advisor for the film that's going to deal with all of that, the organization of that, and the temperature checks, the questionnaires every day. Just the COVID police that's going to be on set. So.
Do you have an idea of what budget that's going to be, or what part of the budget that's going to be? Like how much it's going to cost?
$50K.
Whew.
Yeah.
And what's your crew size on this one? Like 30 or something, or a little less?
Trying to stay less than 30 or right around 30. Derek smiles because it was higher at first. But I always come back to Derek and say, got to mitigate risk, buddy. And then he's like,
well, I wanted a longer. I mean, we had 19 days on Redstone. We had 3 double digit page days, and
we don't want that again. Yeah. We don't want to do
that. So I was like, 25 day shoot. And Jason's like, 20. I'm like, 22. All right, back. We'll so go at 21.
20, yeah.
Three more days.
Well, this has been really genuinely a good conversation. I don't say that every time. So let's dip into our final five questions. These are like the long view questions where each of you would answer with regard to your career and your, you know, your emotions. Yeah. So both of you, what's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
Jason, you want to go first?
Yeah.
You want me to go?
No, I'll go first because mine's easy because I've never... So my career, and I actually have a full-time job, which is nuts because I'm also producing now, but I've been working in industry since the 90s and I'm traditionally a 3D animator. So I made an animated film, short, 30 minutes long. They were actually episodics. That was my first, that was mine. So, and I actually have a feature in the works right now that we just finished the animatics on. And we'll go into production with it at some point, probably 2021. So it's, I don't know, those actors, you can tell them what to do and they do it and they don't get sick, right? Because they're just animated characters. So that's an easy thing. Yeah, for me, it's easy. Derek?
When you say first film, are you referring to feature or short?
Doesn't matter, whatever you want, however you want to answer it.
All right, well, the first short I ever made, I think, was a, two action figures that killed each other. And then my mom walked in, she made a cameo. That was like in the '90s. But my first feature was, called, Cronus. And it was a sci-fi fantasy. And I think what I took away from that, I like I said, I grew up idolizing guys like Terry Gilliam and, Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Tim Burton, these guys like that. And I think what I learned from that was how to do the visual side of a film, you know, color scheme, storyboarding, putting it together, having some sort of consistency, you know, in the images, not just, oh, we're going to shoot right now, you know, having an order to it. And, you know, I look back on it with, it's kind of what helped me get to these guys here, you know, with Jason and stuff.
We met on Cronus, film.
And that was shot 8 years ago.
I colored Cronus. I was a colorist on Cronus. Maybe. And that's how we.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He was a colorist on Cronus. And so, yeah, you know, in the shuttle, that was the first feature that I did. I mean, I made one in the, when I was a little bit younger than that one. Do you guys familiar with Panasonic DVX 100A cameras from back in that day?
Yes.
One of the first,
that was one of the first things I used back in, film school.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I bought me one of those and we went down into the, I don't want to say sewers. There was like these underground tunnels in Dallas. And I spent like 3 months on my shooting this really weird little feature. And again, it was, you know, cause those have set lenses. I had to buy I bought a wide angle lens adapter so I could do like an 11 to 12 millimeter kind of look like a Gilliam or a Malick movie. And went down there and spent months shooting that one and it came out and it sat there in an editing base. No one's ever seen it. In fact, I don't even know where it's at. That was the first feature, you know, you're working on it and it teaches you a lot what not to do. And that's what I took away from Cronus as well, was what not to do.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
I would say so far that, and it's so cheesy, but it's so true, which is you're only as good as your last film. When I think about that term that I was told was, I think it means that, you know, you got to take every single second you're on a movie set, you're extremely lucky. I mean, it's a mixture of luck and hard work, but if you really think about the process of filmmaking, if you think about how much money is put into it, even $100,000 or $50,000 or $20,000, that's somebody's money. You know, that's some, especially in the indie world, that's an investor's money. That's their personal money, whether they inherited it or whether they worked their butt off for it. And if you think about consistently trying to do this as a living, you know, you can kind of get a little depressed about thinking like that, like, man, this may be the last film I ever make. And it very well may be the last film you ever make for a variety of reasons. I know I'm going dark here, but it's true, you know? And so when they say you're always good at your last film, it's like, I always pretend. And I told this to my cinematographer on Whitetail and I told it to him on Redstone the first day. I said, okay, after this film, you and I are going to be taken out to a field and we're going to be beaten to death and we will never live again. And this is the last thing we're ever known for. And after he said, man, you're really fucked up, Derek. I said, yes, I know, but you get what I'm saying, right? And he's like, yeah, you could have just said, make a good movie. I was like, oh, you know what I'm saying? and I'm serious. That's the best advice. It's like, just pretend you're never going to make another film again. Yeah. Okay. That's mine.
What was the question?
What's the best filmmaker advice you've ever gotten? Like anyone's like, given you?
Because I use this a lot in my world now, is trying to work with good people only. Like that's my rule now. I just want to work with cool people. I want to work with responsible people. I want to work with people that kind of have the same vision and outlook, you know, that they're in it because they want to be in it. And so I think Derek's that guy. I mean, he and I, after Cronus, we didn't talk for years, and then we reconnected on Whitetail and now Redstone, and now we're partners, and we're going to do this thing big now. But if I hadn't seen or worked with him on Cronus and then just seen his attitude and going forward and then working with him on Whitetail, we wouldn't be here today for sure. And so I kind of have that rule. And with all the people that I work with and work for, we're all kind of like that. Neil's like that. So I think he sees it. He sees it in us. We see it with him. So we both kind of trust each other, even though we just met on a movie set 3 months ago.
I call that the asshole test. Yeah, I'm totally on board with that. Yeah. What are your goals as filmmakers, whether they're monetary or award-wise? Like, what are you shooting for if you can think beyond dying in a field and being put out to pasture?
Oh, well, that was my answer. I just don't want to be put out in the field. When I was younger, you know, it was making those movies like, I said, Cronus, and there's another horror film that I kind of made. But that those films... Yeah. those movies were I want to be I've never cared about being famous or any of that stuff because I'm too pessimistic to believe in that stuff, but I've always thought I want to make good movies where people see them, and that's what I care about, you know. And the older you get, you realize, man, I think at this point my goal is to make films that I love, and I just want to be able to pay the rent doing it. I don't want to have odd jobs in between. I want to be able to pay the rent, keep the lights on, provide for my son, provide for my family, and be able to make narrative films. So, and that's asking a lot, as we know, but that's my goal. That's it.
Yeah. I'll say this because people don't know Derek, and I know this guy now. He is very genuine when he says that, like, because most guys might say that, but then they really want to get these $20 million, $30 million budgets, get an Oscar, be known. And he's like, I just want to make good films. And because we go back and forth on this sometimes, because I I'm like a serial entrepreneur. I want to make films, but I also want
to
make
producer.
Money because I know we need that.
That's so
that
all. That's okay.
Yeah.
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 I'm a producer, but I want to keep doing it. And the only way to keep doing it is if we can sell them. Right. And so Derek and I have to, we have to come to arrangements or agreements on stuff. Like, it'd be great if we had this person because this person brings this much weight. And maybe they're not as good as an actor as you wanted for this role, but let's look at the long term. Like, this is what they'll cost us, and this is what we might be able to get from that. So that's the way I look at it a lot. But I'm also an artist myself. So, and my background is graphic design, 3D animation, and visual effects. And so I've been behind the scenes for so long. And one day, I think I want to direct something. Derek and I have talked about that. And that's why we have this little company now. And I'm not in a hurry. I'm going to help him. And we'll go forward from there and see what happens.
So go more of like the Brian Grazer path. Is that where you see yourself in 20 years, God willing, or whatever?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe.
I see your Top Gun poster, so I kind of like get a sense for you as a producer already. I'm like, okay, I see where you're headed.
That's a funny story about this poster. So it's an original Top Gun poster, and Top Gun. Nice. I was growing up, I grew up with Top Gun and Tony Scott, and I wanted to be a pilot after watching Top Gun. I never wanted to make movies at all.
Oh, that's funny.
I just wanted to be a pilot. My dad was in the Air Force, but when we were in Corsicana, there's this little funky shop downtown, and my daughter was there, and she went in there, and she knows I'm a Top Gun fan because every time it's on TV, I'm watching it, and my wife will walk in, she's like, "Oh my gosh!" Like, so. My daughter said, "Hey, I got you this poster and at the store." I was like, "Oh, that's cool." And so I talked to the owner of the store because it wasn't framed yet and she had it framed for me. And so when I go in there to pick it up, I had to pay for it. I thought my daughter had bought it for me, but she's like, just put it on hold for me. So
Oh, that's funny.
I had to get it. But no, I don't know. I think I'm a good producer. I'm just a business-minded guy, and I kind of look at, try to see the big picture of everything. So,
what's good about Jason is that he has that side of him that is, he is a producer now, but he started from the creative, and he, you know, he's a smart guy, so he could pick up on all the things that I can't do, like all the paperwork and things like that, that I'm, you know, I'm like, overwhelmed, and he knows how to do it. And, but at the same time, he's not, you know, he's not the guy that's just looking at how to make money. He's also like, well, it's got to be good. Otherwise, I mean, he straight up told me,
I don't want to do it if it's not good.
Well, not just that, but also too, he wants to make sure that he not just likes it, but and it's good. Cause you know, you could look at a script and go, well, I don't like it, but I can tell it's a good script. And he just doesn't want to do it if he doesn't want his name on it and it's in his style and a way of doing it. So it's like, we're all making the movie. There's not really, we're just different positions, but it's all of our film. We don't ever refer to it as Derek's or Jason's. We say it's our movie.
So next question, if you go back in time, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself?
Mine would be, don't have I guess don't make a deadline and don't pigeonhole yourself as a certain director. I'm going to be completely transparent and like honest here, just throwing myself under the bus. But I think in my 20s, I was consciously making a decision to make only these type of movies. And it was just, you know, I would never make any other kind of film. Like, I don't want to, even though I absolutely, I grew up loving Westerns. I grew up loving these dramatic films, thrillers, you know, some of my favorite movies, but I always wanted to make these science fiction, fantasy, surreal type movies with big epic, you know, set designs and color schemes and budgets and all wide lenses and all this kind of good stuff. And I would sit there and tell myself, no, cannot do anything else. Even if I had a cool idea, even if I had an idea pop up in my head, I wouldn't write it. I'd be like, I'm not gonna do that because it's not me. And I was like, who the hell are you? You're nobody, dude. You're like, you know what I mean? Like, just be creative. If you think of a really unique idea, if it's a romance movie, you know, and then write it. If it's a good idea and you really want to, you know, see it written, then do it. And don't sit there and tell yourself, I have to make it by the time I'm some odd years old. You know what book really messed me up, and I blame it, is that Rebel Without a Crew crap from Robert Roberts.
Yeah.
I'm 23 years old. Whatever, you know. So hey, you read a book like that when you're 18 and you're like, oh God, I got to make movies before I'm 25.
Right.
And then
right.
I would go back in time and say, just chill out, man. You're not even ready to make a film. Not a real, not a good one. You're not old enough. You haven't lived long enough. That's right. Yeah. I'd say give yourself some time.
Don't rush it. Yeah.
Don't rush it.
Yeah. I think that's interesting, Derek, because something I see from you is like, and probably happens to a lot of filmmakers, and that's kind of my advice. Don't be too hard on yourself, right? Like, you can always rebound. You can always pick back up. You can always get another chance at something. And so don't, if you end up doing something that you don't like, well, just do it again and do it better. And so, because you can do it, you have the opportunity to do it better. And I think that's where Derek's getting at there. And I think that advice from Robert is like, I think that's the best. Just go out and make a movie. Go do it, because that's when you just don't know until you do it.
Final question. Is making movies hard?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, it's extremely hard.
It's not hard at all. What are you talking about?
A movie will test you and test you. And like, man, you get to really see, and not you, just anybody, everybody involved in the movie, every position of a film is hard, like for everybody working in that position. And I think that's one thing I try to do as well, is don't, I mean, everybody's got a job and everybody's trying to do their best, or they should be. And so if you see something that's not going the way you think it should go, well, that doesn't mean that they're not doing a good job. That's just you looking outside the box and not knowing what somebody's going through or dealing with. So that's, if you can get in there and try to break it down smaller, right? Not just try to see it from outside, like go there, do that position, go talk to that person and say, hey, how can I help you? What's happening? Cause you may find out some stuff that's going on that you had no idea about. And I think from a producer standpoint, that happens a lot. I don't know why I was going down that rabbit hole, but it's hard. It's extremely hard. Like, people just don't know what's happening.
I think going back to what Jason said earlier was another, when he talked about his advice, was finding good people. I think that makes it less hard. I mean, You know, and I know that sounds like a, well, duh, but you know, you get wrapped up in a situation where you make some films and then, you know, you're with a certain group of people. And, when you realize you're just not having fun, which is what happened to me, you kind of, it's like going through kind of like a divorce in a way. It's hard, but it's just like, this isn't working out. I got to find new people to work with because we don't see eye to eye. And when you find those people, and again, we've only done two films to, as a group, not just Jason and me, but the people. So we don't know everything. But I mean, look, right now it feels like it's getting less hard, even though all the things
we're getting
going on.
Really close with our crew right now. And yeah, unfortunately for Boone, that's going to be a whole new world because that movie we're going to shoot up in Washington. And we want the incentives from the film work in Washington. And that means crewing 75% of Washingtonians. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to
hard.
Yeah.
So which is hard.
Kind of step out of our little box. So that makes it hard again because we got used to working with the guys that we knew, girls that we knew, and now we're having to leave.
You'll be back. Come back.
Yeah, we'll be back. We'll be back.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you for being on the show. Where can people find the two of you? Yeah. Well, if people want to get in contact or like
geographically,
no website, no Twitter.
My Instagram is J Starn, JSTARNE. We have a website for Redstone that we need to start working on now. I don't know.
Whitetailfilm.com.
Whitetailfilm.com. You can see the trailer for Whitetail there.
I mean, I think I don't know if it has contact, but it has our names and stuff. I think my contact's on IMDb Pro or something.
Mine as well.
I'm not a very good social media guy. So
same here.
Like, I don't even have Facebook. I got off of that. So
I don't have that either. It's necessary, and maybe someday we'll resurrect some social for us, but I don't know. But look, I am happy to talk to anyone that wants to reach out for anything. I mean, I've been in post for a long, long time, and I'm happy to help people. Like that's kind of my role too. Is like I help a lot of people, and I want to help people. So Derek's the same way. So if anybody wants to get in touch with us, you guys can share any info as well.
Yeah, I'm excited. You're gonna get 100 emails now. Yeah.
So I'm Jason at jstarn.com. There you go.
Presley.derek@yahoo.com.
There you go.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. Really this has been great.
Yeah. Enjoyed it, guys. Awesome, a lot of fun. Man. You guys are great.
Okay. It is time for You're the Expert. What is this that you may ask? What are you hearing me say right now? This is a segment where our lovely producer, Eric Tom, sources many, many questions from filmmakers, people who write into the show, listeners, his own brain sometimes. It kind of just, it's a big mix of all these different things. And he brings them in and he asks them to us because we're the experts. And they're all questions that he thinks that we are the experts on or that we should be the experts on. So here is this week's question coming in from a random source. It says, hey all, when going on a location scout, what should I be looking for? Dear God Almighty, what a question. Liz, I have a million things to say about this. What do you have to say?
I think I'm going to only focus on a few things in the hopes that you will be able to cover the bulk of this response because there's a gazillion. I mean, I think the obvious ones are like access to power, what the grid looks like. I don't even know what the word is, but like how much power can you absorb from the space? Is there enough room to stage? Is there enough room for a green room? Is there enough room for parking? What I look for is texture and character. So like I learned the hard way that white walls are really unattractive when you film on them, right? So what you want is you want wallpaper, you want, you know, old reliefs coming out of the walls. You want, what am I thinking of? I like wood paneling. I love like a location that has character and texture. Also, if you get to use the furniture or the art at the location, that's something to look at. Like, is there a painting you can move or a set piece you can move that can help tell your story that you won't have to source elsewhere? But there are many other logistical concerns, but I always think about, does this location fit the vision for the film that I have aesthetically? Arik, what about you?
Well, you answered most of the creative things that you could talk about. I mean, I think the other thing is depth, like making sure that there's plenty mm-hmm. of depth, you know, for your camera to capture behind where the scene is happening. So you're not like, even if it is a beautiful, you know, wallpapered wall, that you're not like right up against it with your talent, because the more space that you can give, the better it's going to look. And, you know, the more interesting angles you can capture, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to really talk about the creative stuff, even though I could probably add more onto that. But what I will talk about is, like, I'm going to basically approach this from two perspectives. One, if you have a crew, and two, if you don't. So if you have a crew, make sure that your department heads come to the location scouts.
Yes.
Make sure to have your electrician and your key grip, you know, your gaffer and your key grip come, because they're going to have their own set of unique needs that they're going to have to, like, make sure that the location can provide. And Liz mentioned one of them, the power. Like, the electrician is going to know exactly what to look for in the power, exactly how much power they need from what you're asking from them. And you could try to do this yourself, but it's probably a bad idea. It's better to pay the gaffer to be there on the location scout, and they'll be pissed at you if you don't. And the last thing you want is a pissed off gaffer starting on your production. You should also make sure that your producer is there, of course, that, like, whoever is handling food is at least... they don't necessarily have to be there, the caterer, potentially, but, like, you have to make sure that you have somebody there who is taking notes for the caterer, like the producer or location, even sometimes a location manager, sometimes it's a production coordinator, but just somebody who is, like, thinking about them. Bathrooms, make sure that you are thinking about bathrooms, where the bathrooms
old
are.
Old plumbing, new plumbing.
Yeah. What, like, there, you might even, let's say this has happened to me before. You might see that there are plenty of bathrooms on location, but did you talk to your person who's running the location to make sure that you can access those bathrooms and that they will be available to you at the time of your shoot? Because that is very, very important. Maybe a wedding is happening that day, which, another really great thing to make sure that isn't happening the day that you're shooting your film at said venue, you know? Just to make sure that you're going to have what you're expecting lined up and set up for you. Yeah, parking, really, really important. Access to the location, extremely important. Like, where can you come in with gear? Where can you be? Like, you might see that they have a lot of space, but, like, what are you actually paying for? Like, can you go upstairs to access their upstairs space for a green room or extras holding? Like, all these questions are so, so important. So making sure that you have your full team there with you, DP, you know, gaffer and key grip. If you don't bring sound, make sure that you're taking sound notes for them, like that you're asking, like, you know, is there an air flight over our heads? Like, are there any other noise concerns to be worrying about? Do they have band practice next door to this place at any time? Like, all these questions, there's so many things to cover. So I just make sure that, like, you know, just check in with all your department heads to see if they want to be at the scout, because if they want to be, then they are most likely supposed to be there. But, like, production designer, obviously another one. But, like, makeup probably doesn't need to go. You just need to make sure to tell makeup where they can go, that you have a place for makeup to set up, you know? But, like, let's say you're by yourself and you don't have a big crew. All the things I just said are all questions you should ask. But I would go ahead and, like, talk to other filmmakers or people who have made movies in the past, whatever, and just ask them what questions that they wish they would have asked their location person before they showed up, because, like, whoever's running the locations, because there's just so many things that could come up that you just need to make sure that you're covered for. I think we covered almost all of them.
We didn't cover one thing, but you covered way more than I'd ever think to cover, which is, like, now I, like, want to write down all your points. But bring a camera, even if it's your phone, bring a camera and share the pictures on a shared drive, like a Google Drive or a Dropbox.
You have to take pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because then let's say somebody couldn't come, then they have access to those photos. So, yeah, I usually take photos on my phone. But then sometimes if I bring my DP with me, like, he's fancy boy, he brings his nice camera and then he'll take really great photos with his nice camera. But the thing that's dangerous about that is, like, DP's mind is usually completely focused on the artistic side of things. And you also need pictures for the logistical people, too. Yeah. So, like, you should always bring your cell phone or have a phone ready to, like, take photos with, because like you're going to want to know, okay, here's the room where the wardrobe is setting up. Okay, this is their wardrobe space. Here's the space that X person, is this going to be big enough? Like, let's make sure like we just know all these things so that everyone has what they need going into the shoot day. Because, yeah, I mean, especially if you have a big crew, it can get unwieldy really fast of like what needs to be provided.
I think I've had producers who are really keen on doing the video walkthrough. You know, I don't know if you've ever done that, but if you can't get a blueprint of the location, having someone just walk through the location narrating on video, that also is helpful.
Yeah, make sure that they're thinking about those things too, because if they just narrate, oh, this is the set, this is where the scene's going to take place, this is where the actors are going to go, but they don't talk about bathrooms, they don't talk about, you know, green rooms and extras holding and, you know, all that stuff, like then, you know, there are lots of gaps can happen. So, you know, I've done a lot of producing in my day, and I've done lots of producing of like commercials with like bigger budgets, like 50 to 100 person crews and more. Ooh. So like when you get to that level, it's like all the shit is so fucking important. You have to know exactly like where are all the trucks going to go. Like, you know, got to make sure the trucks have parking, and how many trucks is each department bringing? Oh, we decided last minute that we actually wanted another truck. Oh, fuck, you didn't tell me, so there's no place for it to go. God damn it. So just making sure you're all lined up on all these things.
You're giving me anxiety.
That's why small crews can be nice. Like if you're under 20, it's like, well, you don't have to really worry about like two semi full of like electric gear, because you don't have the crew to bring it all out of the truck anyway.
No one will drive that. Yeah.
Exactly. Anything that we missed, let us know. Send us your thoughts, questions, comments, suggestions to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or a rating. Those are nice too. Thanks again to Nathan Blackwell for leaving us that amazing review earlier on the show. Also, you can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimer, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for simply being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week.